来嘛，不要死嘞，等你嘞，不要死嘞，等你嘞，来嘛来嘛，哎来哎来哎来哎，不要死嘞，等你嘞，放下嘞。
Welcome to New Books in Southeast Asian Studies on iTunes and via the web. I'm your host, Nick Cheeseman. Today I'm talking with Anthony Reed, an emeritus professor at the Australian National University's School of Culture, History and Language, about his latest monograph, A History of Southeast Asia, Critical Crossroads, which Wiley Blackwell published this year, 2015, as the latest installment in their History of the World series. Tony, welcome to the show and congratulations on your latest impressive study.
Thank you, Nick. Pleasure to be here.
When you spoke about the book at the Asia Book Room here in Canberra this June, you revealed that it was 25 years in the writing. Can you please begin by telling us a bit of the backstory to the book, the history of the history, so to speak? When and how did plans to write it begin, and why did it take around half of your long and very productive professional life to complete?
It is an embarrassing question. Indeed, it's precisely half. I've been in the business, I suppose, of writing and teaching for 50 years, and it was 1990 when this book was commissioned. I was embarrassed to be reminded by the publisher when we started appealing to the what's in the contract. My God, it's still there. It's still been preserved somewhere. I suppose it's because when I published the first volume of Southeast Asia and the Age of Commerce, it made a little bit of a splash beyond the Southeast Asian world. I remember the editor of this series that invited me to write saying for him, the Europeanist, for him it had created a new part of the world. So I was enrolled at that early stage when there was a bit of a fuss about that book. But as I said, I've got lots of books I have to write, and this is a book for somebody later in the career, summing everything up. And so, if it's okay, I'll leave it a few years. Later, I decided, at several points on my life, I said, this is ridiculous. You give me an advance. I'm sorry, here is the money back. Please forget it. I'll go. And they said, no, we want you to be guilty. We want you to feel. And somehow the people managing this series were still there. I finally got around to it about 5-6 years ago when I'd done all the other urgent things that had to be done. And maybe it's an element of truth in this idea that some books are better written at a late stage. I think that's probably true.
And so you do feel that's the case with this book? As you said, it's a summing-up book.
It is. I know myself the feeling I've had with certain books and theses come across my head. Well, who the hell is he to write that book? You know, what can seem the impertinence of some 22-year-old something like that to, you know, turn everything on its head. One does somehow in some ways defer to the older guys. Okay, well, if somebody else had done it, I might have said ridiculous hubris to skate so lightly over the whole thing. But in one sense, I have got beyond that and feel as if I felt in writing it as if I was saying everything I needed to say about Southeast Asia, of a big picture Southeast Asia. And there's lots of books I still haven't written that I would have liked to write. But in terms of the big picture, gender, for example, I always thought I should write a book about that. Religion, I thought I should write a book about that. But at one level, I've, you know, put it all in.
Well, let's turn to some aspects of that big picture. You mentioned gender, and that's one of the themes that runs throughout the book. You talk a lot about the role of women in Southeast Asian economies and societies and suggest that that role has been grossly underestimated. So can you speak to that aspect of the book and why you think that's the case?
I came up with this idea in the 80s, I guess, when I was writing the book that became Southeast Asia and the Age of Commerce, discovered from reading all the accounts of outsiders who come into this region, whether it's mainland or island, South Asia, the same kind of shock on the part of travellers in the 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th century, that women are doing so much of the work, that women are doing all the business, the marketing, the buying and selling. It was a shock for Chinese, and it was a shock for Europeans, and it was a shock for Northern Indians. So, but all of those peoples found that they had to deal with women, and indeed to find a woman, to live with a woman and split the business with her was an extremely advantageous. So I believe then, as in writing that book, which was essentially about the 15th to 17th century, the pre-colonial South Asia, that this was an extremely important phenomenon, and I think I established that, and it's more or less become a cliche or an established idea. I think about early South Asia or pre-colonial. What I hadn't addressed was what happened with modernism. Is that still the case, or is that just a quaint piece of the past of no great relevance? And I did find that troubling and necessary to address. And as you will have seen in the later chapters, I deal with it essentially by looking at the impact of colonial modernity on Southeast Asia. I talk about modernity later, but essentially I want to see modernity not as meaning the place we're at now, but meaning a particular mindset which dominated Europe in the late 19th, early 20th century, which was extremely gendered, which believed that women should be in the home, having lots of children, if you think of Victorian England, for example, and that men should be in the workplace, and that there should be a split like this, and that this is part of the sort of urbanism that transformed industrial countries at that time, which meant that women weren't safe anymore. In the village, they can work, but once they're in the city, that this kind of domesticity, dressed up with all kinds of Puritan religious explanations, was essential. So this was the form in which modernity was eventually accepted as a goal by Southeast Asians around 1900. Up till then, they'd on the whole resisted a lot of the things the Europeans brought. But around 1900, give or take a decade or so, everywhere the same sense took hold that this phenomenon, this mindset that has delivered railway trains and telegraphs and newspapers and canned goods and all kinds of advantages, the telephone. We want these things. We can't go on resisting. We want them, and it seems that part of the package is this patriarchy. So that was the way I looked at this. Basically, that modernity as, in part, a means of controlling women and domesticating them, but unsuccessfully in the end.
You're skeptical about modernity in that period, or like the promises of modernity, partly because I gather when you compare it with earlier periods that you studied in depth, you find that it falls rather short, and that in so many respects there were more, here I'm not just talking about women, but for the societies and economies of Southeast Asia, there were more opportunities and there were more and different kinds of prospects to those that emerged in the late colonial period. Can you tell us something about one or another of the aspects of those earlier periods, whether it's the age of commerce that you discuss at length in one part of the book or other earlier periods?
You mean what went wrong, as it were? Is something that was flourishing in that earlier period?
Well, for instance, you refer to how the infrastructure that the late colonial period brought mesmerized, I think is the term that you use, historians, led them to think of this as a period of high industrialization and economic growth. You say that evidence is now emerging that even in the age of commerce, in actual fact, as a result of the interaction of Chinese merchants and traders, there was a greater amount of economic production and exports from the region compared to subsequently.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm glad you picked up that point. Indeed, I've spent some time arguing that. In the age of commerce, I mean, that was a particular period when trade brought great benefits to Southeast Asia, when Southeast Asia was, in a sense, the center of the unification of the world, and that it was the place that produced the spices, which Europe went crazy about, and that, of course, the reason that Europe discovered America and discovered Asia was that they were off in pursuit of the spices, which essentially located in Southeast Asia. So it gave Southeast Asia a central role and brought enormous sudden wealth to the trading routes around Southeast Asia. That period ended in the what I call the 17th century crisis, partly, most obviously, because the Dutch trading company, the Dutch East India Company, succeeded in monopolizing the key spices and therefore reducing the benefits for Southeast Asians from the spice trade to almost zero, but harvesting great benefits for the company itself at the cost of a huge infrastructure to control everything, to build forts and jails. But even after that, setback, which was a crisis and which did lead to a period when foreign trade seemed much less attractive and there was a kind of vernacularization of Southeast Asian societies, you have another boom in the late 18th, early 19th century, which is essentially generated, as you say, by Chinese, by Americans, by others breaking the monopolies of the English and Dutch, and giving rise, again, to a more rapid period of export growth, and that's the only thing you can measure. As the economic historians have relatively few tools that are really, really concrete and satisfactory for the period before the 19th century, but export trade, international trade, is the key one, and this certainly grew strongly before high colonialism than during it. High colonialism was actually a period of macroeconomic stagnation. That's now clear, where colonial writers tended, I mean, they hadn't done the sums, I mean, there was much that hadn't been done, couldn't have been done then, but they tended to see the story as one of building the infrastructure, the railways, the harbors.
Let's go back to some other themes in the book, and we'll return to these points shortly. And if you don't mind, I'd like to talk about the state. You tend to write against studies that emphasize or perhaps arguably overemphasize the role of the state, studies of state formation with which political scientists fund. Why is that the case? And again, can you pick up on some aspects of the book that speak to this position you hold?
Well, thank you. I say at the beginning that I think Southeast Asia is a good place to start on a project of de-emphasizing the state. But I really see it as something which historians have been trying to do of late and have increasingly realized is part of the modern mission. History as a discipline arose with the European nation state in the 19th century. And it believed that its task was to chronicle the rise of those states. Looking back on it, now that we've become rather critical of nationalism, it used to be part of our genes, perhaps, or at least part of the way we were brought up in the 40s, 40s, 50s, 60s. But now that we're more critical of it, we can see that it's a particular phase. And that what we were chronicling as historians was necessarily exaggerating mightily that particular story. It gave us a storyline. If you think of English schoolboys being able to recite the Kings of England or Australian schoolboys being able to recite the Prime Ministers of Australia, as if that was the key thing. I mean, that was the storyline. That's, it's the politics, it's the state that provides the story. Now, once you say, well, really, is that the most important thing you can say about the past? There's one prime minister to replace another, or one king? Of course it isn't. Southeast Asia, as I say, is a good place to show how other stories can be seen to be much more important, because the state really was late to make a big difference in people's lives. That's my take, that this was a place, a part of the world, where stateless peoples were able to remain stateless right up until the end of the 19th century. Indeed, in some places, even now, hardly aware of the state, particularly in highlands and small islands, and these sort of refuges of liberty, you might say, being free of the state. It enables you to think, well, I mean, but do they have a history? Of course they have a history. But if we try to figure out what their history is, it'll help us see, well, other people's histories are also much more varied than that of the state. So it seemed to make Southeast Asia a good test case to try to develop other stories, other huge changes than the ones that my intellectual ancestors, the ones who sort of invented Southeast Asian history, thought they were doing.
So how did Southeast Asia work against the types of state formation that we see in India or China in that same period?
Well, my standard explanation is environment. I mean, you can't explain everything by environment, but that's clearly a lot of it. Southeast Asia is a place of forest and water where marching armies, such as controlled the Roman Empire or the Chinese Empire, don't really get much purchase. And the Chinese found that, of course. The Chinese relentlessly moved south with their bureaucratic state and their marching armies, and they built roads and they organized supplies so they could cross enormous distances. But once they got to the tropical environment of dense forests and heavy rainfall and impassable rivers, things became very difficult, and tropical diseases, which they were less familiar with. These factors are very important, I think, that they made Southeast Asia less congenial to large state-building projects, and at least until you had maritime empires such as the British and Dutch. But there's perhaps another factor which has only recently occurred to me, and I think to the profession. Since the tectonic theory has become established, which was really only 20, 30 years ago, we realized what an extraordinarily vulnerable part of the world this is. I mean, the most populous and dangerous part of the Ring of Fire, where earthquakes, volcanoes are everyday occurrences. That is now clear, and it was made extremely clear to me and to everybody in the 2004 tsunami in Sumatra. But if you think, I mean, since then, of course, I've been rethinking how I feel about Southeast Asian history and making amends for the fact that I never mentioned earthquakes and volcanoes and tsunamis in anything I've written before. It does seem to me that this must be part of the explanation for why coast-based, agriculturally-based states were periodically wiped out or at least set back. That the states which were built on exposed coasts would tend to suffer disproportionately and totally in tsunamis. States that were based on agriculture, as all states are, of course, would suffer especially from the mega eruptions which cause a huge floor of ash and acidification of the air and so forth, make agriculture impossible for a decade. So this kind of disaster must probably have been part of the reason why some of the states that we saw beginning to form in the 8th, 9th, 10th centuries didn't continue.
And similarly, you attribute that reason to, or that's one reason for the end of the age of commerce, the long 16th century, that natural disasters again affected low-lying states.
Yes, there isn't a single big natural disaster you can point to that did it. But climatic changes are thought now to have been a big factor. We can more easily point to some earlier spectacular changes to in the Bangkor or 13th century and so forth, the general period of crisis in the 13th century. Climatic and other natural phenomena causing that. But in the 17th century, there's also clearly a change in the rainfall patterns. That is part of the explanation there, but I can only say a part, not whole.
So these environmental climatic features go to some of the reasons as to why at certain points in time states decline, but you also seem to be taking, correct me if I'm wrong, but an analytical position against emphasis on the state, perhaps for other reasons. For instance, you talk about one of your concerns in this book being, quote, to correct distortions imposed by reading back modern concepts of state into times and places where they don't belong. So, again, I wonder if there's something more to it than just a rise and decline.
Yeah, of course there is. And I suppose part of this is about the discomfort with nationalist historiography. In my earliest days, of course, I was part of the enthusiastic rejection of colonialism and embracing of the new nationalisms. It was also exciting. But once nationalist myth-making took off and then became enforced as a sort of requirement that textbooks would only teach this kind of nationalist myth, it became a little more disturbing for the historian to see what distortions were taking place. I mean, the most obvious distortions are on the part of that kind of nationalist historiography, which like to talk about the great glories of the past as if they were states with prime ministers and ministers of finance and foreign ministers and so forth, as if these were states like the modern states that were trying to be constructed in the 20th century. So that's a discomfort. And I suppose that I'm inspired to take this view, not just by irritation, I hope, with the nationalist writers, but also with the notion that we're living in a post-nationalist, globalized world, where we can no longer afford this kind of nationalist distortion. We have to write, this is now fundamental, we have to write as if we are all on this planet together, and that kind of partisan history that only writes the history of us and defines us in some arbitrary way to be read back to somehow, you know, people in the 14th century or somehow us against them, that kind of history is not only wrong and distortion, but it's destructive of the kind of world we need to live in today.
So one of the features of Southeast Asia that you speak to throughout the book in these terms is an expression you use that I like is civilization without cities. And indeed, one of the themes you identify at the beginning of the book also is how the cultural and economic structures of Southeast Asia differed from elsewhere and how they can inform our understanding of human progress. So perhaps you could say something more about what form this civilization without cities took in different periods, its economic and social dimensions. We've touched on women, of course. Another feature of the book that I was interested in was, for instance, was reciprocities between coastal and interior producers and how the type of economic relations that developed then enabled this civilization without cities across Southeast Asia.
I recall at the end of the book where I'm trying to be upbeat about, you know, saying that despite a lot of manifest dangers and problems with religion and conflicts, etc. What holds Southeast Asian societies together is a sort of inherent valuing of civility in social relations, which has come. So I think there is something in this, that pattern of valuing interpersonal harmony, avoiding a self-assertive conflict in everyday interpersonal relations, is something that goes far back, and it was never constructed by a strong state that required this kind of behavior, but rather by a pattern of firstly religion and secondly performance. And that is popular culture as dispersed through typically performances at every kind of festival, every kind of marriage or event, where there would be a play, a puppet show, or some kind of performance, which would extol the correct manner of polite, civilized behavior, always marred with less correct buffoonery from clowns and so forth, which you knew that was more fun, but that's not how you're supposed to behave. You're supposed to behave like these very elegant, low-key people who don't raise their voice and don't. I think, the civility thing can be overdone, it is a feature of Southeast Asia, and it's not one that has been built by states. If we think also about what created a Vietnamese culture or a Javanese culture or a Bama culture, sure, there were states that embraced most of those people who speak those languages and embrace those cultures, but for rather short periods. Very short periods in which we can really say some sort of state is coeval with that civilization. In the Vietnamese case, as we know from the time when Vietnam started to expand down the southern half of what is now Vietnam, from the very beginning, it was two Vietnams. It was not a state, it was two states. And they varied greatly. The expanding one, the southern one, were, of course, extremely heterogeneous and engaged with charm, Khmer, and Montagnard. And yet, a Vietnamese culture emerged, even though there's a very short period in which there's a state that was only about a century, the 19th century, in which Vietnam was in any sense united politically and then in a very fragile way. And yet the idea of the Vietnamese culture is very strong. That's even more true in Java, where the period for which it was a Javanese state is perhaps 30 or 40 years in the 17th century, when there was a gunpowder king, you might say, a short-lived period of strong centralized rule. But all the rest of the time, Java has been very disunited. But there's no question that the Wayang is a very Javanese thing, and its stories are shared and loved, and that has been so since way, way back. It's described even by Raffles back in the 1800s, that this is how the culture is transmitted. This is how people know what their culture is. In China, people knew what their culture was essentially, at two levels. There's the literati written culture of the classics, which is state level, what holds us together. There's also popular religion, of course. But the state level thing just didn't really operate much in Southeast Asia, except for, to some degree, wanted a degree here. It was rather the popular culture thing and the popular religion.
So you would be saying for someone who visits Southeast Asia and goes to the sites like Bagan, Angkor, or Borobudur, that what they're looking at are really exceptions to the story of Southeast Asian history rather than the centerpieces that they're so often held up to be, or have I perhaps misinterpreted your work?
It's a good question. The Angkor in particular is hard to fit into my scheme. But Bagan and Borobudur, I'm quite happy to embrace as and to have re-examined. But what are they really? Are these royal cities, or are they great sacred centres of popular piety? I have no doubt that it's the latter. If we think of Borobudur, I mean, early historians struggled hard to find kings that could explain this, about how this thing was built, and how they could explain that, you know, not that far away, about 40 kilometers away, was wonderful Hindu buildings built at the same period. How there could be two different strong states doing different things. The truth, I think, particularly with the Buddhist monuments, is that this was part, these were built by the donations of ordinary folks, or at least the great plurality of folks, because they had some resources to complete it. But we have inscriptionary evidence of lots of these, particularly Pagano, all the people who built different towns, and it's not different. That's why there were so many. Angkor is a it does look like a big bad bureaucratic state, and it's not nothing that is called Angkor. It's actually Agada state, and I believe there are some environmental reasons why that became a very successful polity controlling the waterworks and the cycle of agriculture in the area north of the Tonglesa. It's a particular advantageous location, which they worked very well for several centuries. But even so, the new work on Angkor is seeing vastly more plurality than the early. The early work saw it as a succession of Jayaramana, the first Jayaramana, the second Jayaramana, and that these guys did it. Now, I think the archaeology is revealing that the big temples of Angkor are replicated, and the irrigation works of the center of are replicated in all kinds of other small communities in a similar way, as if to say that each community had its own hydraulic system, had its own religious system, so that it wasn't a purely centralized.
Much of the discussion that you have around the Nagara polities concerns Indic religions, but when we get into the later periods, we see increasingly the story is about Islamic traders, the Portuguese emerging with their particular brand of Christianity, and indeed the emergence of what you describe as the first global war fought out in the Indian Ocean on religious lines. Can you say something about that aspect of the book?
Yeah, well, that, of course, made a huge difference, and it was the Portuguese intervention in the Indian Ocean that changed profoundly the nature of maritime interaction, because the Portuguese had been crusading against the Muslims in their own country, in Portugal, and then they continued that in Morocco and down the coast of Africa. And they came into the Indian Ocean with the same mix, perhaps even more powerful mix of economic motive. We want to get the spices. We want to get them directly by them through Venice and Cairo along that Muslim-controlled route. We want to get the spices. But also, we're quite happy to hammer the Muslims to do it. We feel entitled to raid every Muslim ship and attack every Muslim fort where we think there's enough. A new kind of element of, in a sense, of barbarity, of saying to take this offensive is okay. That maybe that only describes the first 20 years of the Portuguese, because of course that's a very short term strategy, and you soon realize that you can only do business if you accommodate people and so forth. But it did create a Muslim reaction. It did create an appeal from all the Muslim centers around the nation to the big Muslim power of the world, which was Ottoman Turkey. And the Ottomans controlled both ends of the Suez, what we now see as the Suez Canal, the Eastern Mediterranean and the Red Sea and so forth. So they appealed to Turkey. Send some fleets out and get these guys out of it. They appealed on religious grounds, of course. Turkey controlled the holy places, Mecca, Medina. And we want to do our pilgrimage to Mecca and Medina. The Portuguese are appearing, please come. And you had an interesting globalization around Eurasia, at least, of the battle between Habsburg, Catholic Spain, and the Ottomans, which, of course, on the ground in Southeast Asia, that identification of political interests, religious interests, economic interests, in the polarization between Portuguese and Europe, that profoundly changed things. And it meant that, for me, that's a decisive moment in the definition of who's an Uplander and who's a Muslim in the Muslim parts of Southern Sahara. Islam became a political project, which was an economic project to dominate the spices, keep the domination of the spices, and to attack the Portuguese. And then therefore to attack anybody who wasn't on this side of that context. And so those who felt themselves attacked, who had not been Muslims, had felt they could do business with the Portuguese, tended to retreat up to the hills and become what we call stateless people, become the island savages, whatever, of later times. I mean, this is part of my story of how to give stateless peoples a history, to see that they were not always stateless peoples. They were not essentially different linguistically and ethnically. They're the same peoples as the lowland peoples, but they, at this point, find themselves as having rejected this sort of package.
Here you have some affinity with James Scott's work on Zomia, and you say that he worked out a similar set of ideas and drew them together for the uplands of mainland Southeast Asia that you had already been thinking through on the archipelagic regions. No, if you would like to discuss that aspect of the book any further before perhaps we turn back to modernity.
Well, I know Jim Scott pretty well, and ever since he was a graduate student in Baltimore when I was just starting my career. And we've exchanged thoughts on this a lot. He wants to tell you a little bit. Certainly he's influenced me a good deal. When the book came out, I mean, this was a real broadside. I mean, I knew, you know, we were talking about these ideas of statelessness being a choice, being something that actually prefer freedom. It's in effect freedom from the constraints of the government. But when he wrote that manifesto, The Art of Not Being Governed, I felt, well, okay, this releases me. I don't have to, you know, make this argument. It's loud and clear. It's much, much more loud and clear than I would have dared to do. And indeed, very ably done. Well, of course, he sometimes overstates it and doesn't allow too much room for what are obviously the beneficent consequences of having a statement. There are lots of reasons for it. Life is less nasty, brutal, and short when you do have a statement. But so I took that as part part of the toolkit I had to deal with since it came out, just as I was getting this thing into a final stage. And the other book that came out, of course, later was Rick Lieberman's book, which in a sense is an opposite book. This is a very big book tracing the way in which the state did expand. So the Asian state expanded, he's argued, in the same way that the European state, the Chinese state, that the states became ever more large, centralized, culturally integrated. So they seem to be both saying irreconcilable opposite things, but in fact both are, of course, expressing a truth, an important truth, but part of it. So I hoped to steer a course between these two. But clearly, in terms of novelty, what I have that's new to say, I am more Jim Scott in that, although I'd say discipline and what I do like quite a bit, but in terms of being excited by this idea, how do we give stateless peoples a history? How do we acknowledge that the state isn't the whole story, that it isn't as if, oh, you missed the bus, so you don't exist. The bus is the state, and it's going in this direction. If you missed, well, sorry, you don't know. We have to do better than that. And I was excited by that challenge. Yeah, excited.
Well, whoever comes out on whichever side of that argument, it's clear from your text that, and indeed from others as well, that as you put it, with the emergence of higher colonialism around about 1880s, one of the key changes was the ending of autonomy for state evaders. And you point to how the fixing of borders had been part of a state practice for a long time, but there were really very new implications in this period. Among the other implications of the period, and perhaps we can come back to where we started the discussion at this point in this late period and then into the 20th century, you say that the colonizers succeeded in creating a sophisticated system for export agriculture, but one that, on the other hand, discouraged manufacture, hardened economic dividing lines into racial ones, and succeeded in producing stagnant economies through European-owned monopolies that trapped most of the rural population in Southeast Asia in poverty. Sounds almost like the inverse of the age of commerce. So I wonder if you could talk us through again some features of this period and why you've made quite a strong statement in this respect.
Yes, I suppose this is my economic historian's judgment of high colonialism in a way that's, I suppose, it's true opposite to some of the books I read when I was a student in long time ago, which saw the infrastructure being built as if that was the birth of the modern economy. In some ways it was, but it was not the birth of entrepreneurship. It was, in a sense, the death of entrepreneurship, because these were government-linked enterprises, especially in the 19th century and before. It was an entirely state company, a monopolistic, mercantilist enterprise, even in the 19th century, as much like that. Even when the colonial powers adopted what they saw as a liberal policy of allowing investment from all quarters, the Europeans in Southeast Asia remained a small group who knew each other, who had cozy arrangements between private enterprise and companies, where the degree of real competition was rather low. What you had in each of these colonies was a handful, four or five big banks and big companies and big, as they call trading houses, Austin Prosper and the city, that handled all the business. That were very cozy with the government. They all went to the same clubs and so on. And really, the great majority of the population were not part of that. And then you had the Chinese, who were not just that they were entrepreneurial inclined. Of course they were. They were, as an immigrant group, every immigrant group is inclined to have to find that they get into business because they can't get into agriculture so readily. So they were that way inclined. But the way the colonial stasis might developed, the structure developed, in a way, if you wanted to do business, you better call yourself Chinese. If you wanted to do agriculture, you better call yourself Burmese or Jowies or something. I mean, of course, in Burmese case, we have to meet Indians. That's filling most of the roles that Chinese play elsewhere. Part of this, I venture the idea, somewhat perhaps tentatively, because it's unknowable fundamentally. But I did try to link the failure of the indigenous population throughout Southeast Asia, or their, if you like, their retreat from entrepreneurship, to the maleness of the colonial project. The colonial era and the colonial establishment, whether government or business, was entirely male. There's not a woman in sight. And so modern business seemed to work that way. When the modern European businesses, or indeed Chinese businesses, to a somewhat lesser extent, but even Chinese businesses also were male, looked for indigenous partners, they looked for men. Always. Now, men had not been very good at that. Because men in Southeast Asia have to worry about status. Status is extremely important. And status is hard to reconcile with doing business. Status meant you had to look as if you're a rich dude and you don't care about it. You're above that sort of stuff. No, yeah, take it. They left that kind of business, the haggling, if you like, to their women didn't disappear from business, but on the whole, I mean, the story of colonialism is what happened to the indigenous middle class. There's no entrepreneurs. Southeast Asians became an aristocracy, a tiny aristocracy, who did government and peasantry. So most of Southeast Asia was peasantized. The structures simply made it very difficult. The gender structure among them made it very difficult for indigenous people to get into entrepreneurship. And that's still a marked problem with most of Southeast Asia. But it's, of course, become less so, partly because women have got it back into business. So, in particular, most strikingly in the Philippines, which is one of the world leaders in terms of female entrepreneurship.
You seem to suggest that more generally women in Southeast Asia are relatively more mobile and liberated than their counterparts in many other parts of Asia and indeed around the world, as a result primarily of their pre-colonial heritage and the continuity of traditions from earlier periods, then what in a sense look almost like perverse claims of the late European colonizers that they somehow had something to do with the liberation of women, when your suggestion is that it was very much the opposite.
I am suggesting that, yes. What the claims about liberating women are especially directed at very aristocratic women. So the King and I story of Anna Lenoir, which of course became very popular, is a story about a unique monarchy, the biggest surviving monarchy in Southeast Asia, which was exceptionally, the monk would only became king and stopped being a monk when he was about 55 years old, I think. But he had something like 40 wives and more than 100 children. So that was a bizarre world. The reality, well, the other part of that is that liberating women or protecting women, it was, of course, in the colonial era, it wasn't about liberating, it was about protecting. The European idea was that women should not be out there in the workplace in dangerous situations where they might be exploited or something. So, I mean, there was a protective idea. There was perhaps one of the earliest attempts by the International Labour Organization during the League of Nations time in the early 1920s, they tried to pass an international statute saying no women should work after 5 o'clock in the evening. Anyway, and in Holland, they signed up for that because very few women worked in Holland anyway, certainly not respectable women. One of the least favorable places for women to work in the world. But then they tried to extend it to the Indies, and of course all the employers said, you must be joking, you know, women without factories, women co-ops. Our factories are based on women. Women do the production, the tobacco factories, the cloth factories. They were staffed by women, as they were not in Europe. So this was sort of heavily defeated. So yes, part of the rhetoric of European was to protect them, but also to be fair, to educate them. And education was, of course, the business of religion, mostly, and all the religions, and they're all the major religions in Southeast Asia, of course. External to Southeast Asia, they all came from much more patriarchal places, and they all were very patriarchal. They all thought our kind of sacred education is only for men. So in that sense, the Europeans did protect them. They brought the idea that even the moderns should educate them.
I'm going to jump to the final parts of the book, and listeners are going to have to take a look at the text for themselves to learn more about the revolutionary and nationalist movements of the pre-Second World War period. After the Second World War, we turned from high colonialism to high modernism, and one of the aspects of the work here that struck me was you talk about the paradoxical, unprecedented embrace of modern European cultural and political norms. So what happened in this period that there was this seemingly paradoxical embrace?
I do think, I mean, it is paradoxical. We did imagine, I suppose, when we first embraced these revolutions that brought independence to Southeast Asian countries, that it was some sort of return of Asian culture. But in fact, the people who inherited those revolutions were exceptional, truly exceptional modernizers. The Europeans had, up until the First World War, and then we'll say that 30, 40 years before 1914, the Europeans had also had a lot of confidence in their model, that the only European model really works for the world, so we can cheerfully try to impose it on everybody, European-type law and commercial norms and so forth. But they never thought of imposing this in the cultural or religious domain and changing people's habits and dresses. But the new revolutionary states actually did dream those dreams. They imagined that what we would do was build new Indonesians, new Filipinos, new Vietnamese, new Burmese, that we would build new modern country that was united by the revolutionary struggle and by all the wonderful education and so forth that we're going to introduce, not by its cultural distinctiveness. Indeed, the cultural pattern was very diverse in those countries. But it seemed to net a little. So for a while there, in the 50s and 60s, there was a distinct downplaying of the traditional, of the Asian. And I mean, obviously, the embrace of Western dress, for example. I mean, how did that happen? Why did it happen that everybody suddenly started looking the same? I mean, in a sense, it happened everywhere in the world, but much more so in Southeast Asia than in South Asia. Western dress is still quite common. Many things in India are still much more entrenched. So, the particularly the revolutionary countries, Vietnam, Indonesia, Korea, it's epitome in Pol Pot's Cambodia. Ghastly, according to this. But also Singapore, you know, with the extraordinary chutzpah of Lee Kuan Yew, to think that he could totally reinvent the society. From people, kampong dwellers living in little villages with coconut trees and chickens running around, to put them all in 15-story apartments where they all had to mix with each other in a strange way. That was social engineering of a colossal scale. So, I mean, Pol Pot's breathtaking, appalling idea that, you know, you can impose a single model and throw out everything traditional about Cambodia and all of those past and then you go, was a sort of radical extreme, but even somebody who is generally seen as socially conservative, like Lee Kuan Yew, was very convinced that this first generation was entitled to make these sort of changes. And indeed, because of their status as the bringers of independence, they almost could, not in terms of constructing something new, but in terms of casting off the many old things. So there was a lot of cultural loss, but I think out of it came, for better or worse, out of it came relatively coherent nation states. That's the extraordinary thing. That's, I suppose, one of the extraordinary, unexpected phenomena. Unexpected if you were living in pre-independence Southeast Asia, any of these states. I think you would never have expected that there would have been a single education system which would ensure that everybody throughout these vast, sprawling society spoke the same language and thought, was educated, essentially.
So what does it mean to talk about Southeast Asia today? Is the idea of Southeast Asia still relevant as it once apparently was?
In some of the things which I talked about in earlier periods as uniting, the region, its environment, its material culture, the sort of rice agriculture, and the pattern of food and the pattern of housing. Well, they don't seem so relevant anymore. Everybody lives in cities. Everybody, in a sense, is to that extent like the rest of the world. The environment is much less important once everybody moves around in air-conditioned shopping malls and so on. So in many of those respects, things are different. But nevertheless, the way in which Southeast Asian countries have evolved have created a new kind of distinctiveness, I think. And here I mean distinct from China, distinct from India. I begin that book by saying, you know, this is part of the point, but it's not that you just have the derivative, you know, bits of Indian culture in the Mahabharata and the Ramayana, and bits of Chinese culture, Vietnamese, Confucianism and so on, but rather that these societies have distinctly demarcated themselves from those two leviathans, those two great civilizations. And that's nowhere clearer than ASEAN, and then looking at the response to China's aggressiveness in the South China Sea. Of course, the more that happens, the more unhappy like Vietnam, which might well have felt that they had as much in common with China as with Southeast Asia, more probably. But the more there is a need to assert that being not China, the more Southeast Asia makes political sense in the United States. But I guess I said towards the end that the kind of politics that Southeast Asia has developed, and that you and I and all of us have wrung our hands with grief and woe and lamentation about these soft societies, these corrupt societies that never seem to get their act together. That this is usually analyzed, particularly when Southeast Asia was doing badly economically. We usually analyzed this phenomenon in negative terms. And I mean, we didn't treat them as a collective. What's wrong with Southeast Asia? I mean, much of it was also what's wrong with South Asia. Why is it got so little economic dynamic? Why is entrepreneurship so low? Why is corruption so endemic and nothing that states think they can do actually gets implemented on the ground? I think one can, if we look hard at China and look hard at India, we can be a little more positive in this model. I mean, particularly since economically it has been doing okay, we're now less inclined to say what's wrong with Southeast Asia and sometimes to say what's right with Southeast Asia, particularly if we compare it with other parts of the tropics and the tropical world that has nothing else environmentally quite like Southeast Asia, but anything that is remotely like it, Southeast Asia is doing pretty well. But it is a kind of I wouldn't call it modern thrift, but it is a kind of accommodation which has not been legalistic. And again, many of my colleagues differ from me on this, and I myself am often deeply frustrated that people who commit atrocities and mass murders seem never to be brought to justice, and the system seems not to want to bring them to justice. The way accommodation works seems to preserve this civility, to preserve the sense of harmony, as if we could all be part of a system in which we're reasonably civil to each other, in which we compromise and value a kind of consensus, even if it's a very artificial consensus. Now that is, I think, a kind of reality. Sometimes it makes us wince and protest that justice is not being done. The evil perpetrators of atrocities brought reconciled with the victims rather than be punished. But it is a way of doing things. And it is a way of allowing society to move on. And if one compares with either China, which has a strong state that can get things done, but totally unaccountable state, totally zero marks when it comes to democratization, which Southeast Asia has done much, much better in terms of allowing morality to use, I guess, freedom of expression and so forth, here and there, etc. In South Asia, which of course is a paragon of amazing, bountiful, plural democracy, but it can't liberate its women, and it can't liberate its cuts. And that's an appalling failure of the modern state. So in between those two, little comparisons for the field, the Southeast Asian experiment, such as it is, which needs analysis and needs better minds than mine, much more research than I'm able to to make sense of it as a whole. But I do think it's A, something distinctive, and B, something, to go back to my book, something critical for the world to look at and ponder as to whether this is as worthy of attention as either China or
Tony, at the end of an interview about a book that took a quarter of a century to write, I fear that my closing question may sound a little bit impertinent, but we do have a tradition, for better or worse, on this podcast of asking interviewees what they're working on now and what we can expect from them next. So do you have, I'm sure you do, but would you like to share with us what's going on at the moment by way of another project and what can we look forward to from you in the future?
Well, perhaps three things. Firstly, most importantly and immediately, I feel with this book I've really paid my dues. You know, I've acquitted my obligations to my profession, said, well, if I had something to say, it must be there. That's what I mean. If it isn't there, well, I had every opportunity. So I feel liberated to write my novel. I guess we all sooner or later have to write our novel. So I'm enjoying Little Gantz and writing my novel. But I mean, there's also some other things. One day, somebody should write a history of Aceh, and I suppose it should be me because I've done a lot on Aceh. So, a place I couldn't. One has to be hesitant about writing a national history. I think these days, I mean, I have never done it. I've never written a history of Indonesia or Malaysia or any country, even though I've been asked to do so. And to do it for Aceh when it was in a state of revolt would have been a highly charged and political thing to do, to have to say, well, this is a separate place that has its separate history. But now that peace is restored and Aceh is democratically part of rural Indonesia, I feel I perhaps should do that, although I've written a lot of Aceh. And the third thing is that I get a bit stirred up about is the natural disasters that I mentioned before, that ever since the tsunami in 2004, I've been rethinking what the past must have looked like and realizing it must have been pretty scary at times. It must have been horrendous. And therefore the future, this will recur. And if we had another eruption tomorrow on the scale of even Tambora or Jani in the 13th century, Tambora in 1215, and Jani in 1256, and some others we don't know about, but even those two, which they must recur, then this will be an extraordinary challenge. And it has the effect on me, not apparently on our governments, but on me, of feeling more convinced that Homo sapiens is one with responsibility for this very vulnerable planet, and playing our nationalistic games is time's up. We've done plenty of that. We've done plenty of harm doing it. It's time to regulate this planet rationally, and it's time to prepare for the big disasters when they come, and we have to prepare collectively for those. And it should humble us, as in a sense the tsunami humbled Indonesia and made it realize pursuing this military solution of killing every separatist in Aceh just is obscene. When such a natural disaster I think something like that should make us pull together and think harder about it. So I will play with that theme and try to work harder on understanding past disasters and therefore what future disasters. And try to berate our government. Adjust its thoughts.
Professor Anthony Reed, thank you so much for speaking to us today about a history of Southeast Asia, Critical Crossroads. It's been a pleasure and an honour.
Thanks very much.
And thanks to everyone for listening. I look forward to having you join me again for another meeting with an author on new books in Southeast Asian studies. And if you have time, do check out all of the other great network channels like New Books in History, where this show will be cross-posted. Hey, thank God she get the tender bow. Hey, thank God she get the tender bow.